Today on Off Mic, the city of Gary has a new mayor. What are the plans for Mayor Jerome Prince, and how does he intend to transform Gary back to the Magic City? We talked to a Chicago native who now lives in Puerto Rico. He's having to deal with the earthquakes that have rocked the island over the last week. We get an update on the White Sox, Cubs, and Bulls, and will IU ever win another NCAA title? All this on Off Mic. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she plans to send articles of impeachment of President Trump to the U.S. Senate next week ahead of a trial. Pelosi notified House Democrats today in a letter. She says she plans to consult with them at a Tuesday caucus meeting, after which there could be a House vote. The Trump administration's imposing new sanctions on Iran in response to Tuesday's missile strike on Iraqi bases that host U.S. forces. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. is striking at the heart of Iran's inner security apparatus.
These sanctions targets include the Secretary of the Supreme National Council and the commander of the Basij forces. That's the regime's brute squad, which has in the last few months killed approximately 1,500 Iranians who were simply demanding freedom.
Pompeo also says that Iranian missile is likely to blame for the crash of a Ukrainian passenger jet hours after Iran launched its military campaign into neighboring Iraq. Iran says it still believes the plane crashed because of mechanical problems. The Islamic Republic reportedly has agreed to allow Boeing to help investigate. Boeing, meanwhile, has released more documents detailing internal discussions about problems in the design and development of its now grounded 737 MAX planes. We have more from NPR's David Shaper.
The emails and internal communications show Boeing officials misleading regulators in order to convince them to require only minimal pilot training on the 737 MAX. Some of the messages mock regulators and Boeing's customers, while others raise serious safety concerns. One pilot told his peers, quote, "This airplane is designed by clowns, who in turn are supervised by monkeys." Another employee asks a colleague, "Would you put your family on this aircraft?" "I wouldn't." House Transportation Committee Chairman Peter DeFazio calls the documents incredibly damning and deeply disturbing. In a statement, Boeing apologizes to the FAA, Congress, airlines, and the flying public. David Shaper, NPR News.
Hot weather and gusty winds are prompting officials in Australia to urge 250,000 more people to evacuate their homes today while bushfires continue to burn. We have the latest from Rachel Bongiorno in Melbourne.
Melbournians brave the rain and wind to rally their anger at a government they say isn't doing enough to address the climate crisis unfolding in their country. Wildfires are a natural occurrence in Australia, but the level and intensity of these fires are unprecedented. Around 1 billion animals have perished. An area larger than West Virginia has already burned. Scientists say that climate change exacerbated these fires, with 2019 being Australia's hottest and driest year on record. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Bongiorno in Melbourne.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 100 points since the open at 28,855. This is NPR. More than 18 million people across four southern U.S. states are at risk of violent storm conditions that could include strong tornadoes and flood-generating amounts of rain. The National Storm Prediction Center says Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana could get baseball-sized hail and hurricane-force wind gusts that may top 80 miles per hour. Flash flood alerts are also in effect for many southern and midwestern communities that are at or near flood levels because of earlier storms. It has been more than 5 months since India shut off the internet in its only Muslim-majority state, Jammu and Kashmir. Now, the country's Supreme Court is weighing in on the legality of that move. NPR's Lauren Frayer has details from Mumbai.
India's Supreme Court says the government abused its power when it cut off the internet in its northernmost state. The judges stopped short of ordering the government to turn the internet back on immediately, though. Instead, they called for a review of all restrictions in Kashmir. In early August, India also flooded Kashmir with tens of thousands of troops and put local politicians under house arrest. It also cut phone lines, but those have since been restored. This ruling is a partial victory for the editor of the Kashmir Times, who couldn't publish her newspaper and sued the government for violating freedom of the press. Ruling in her favor, one of the Supreme Court judges said, quote, freedom of internet access is a fundamental right. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Mumbai.
U.S. stocks are trading lower, with the Dow off 88 points at 20,868. The NASDAQ is down a fraction. S&P's down 2 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Noom, a personalized weight loss program designed to give people knowledge to set new goals and the tools to stick to them for good. Learn more at Noom, NOOM.com, and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Well, it's been a really busy 2 weeks for our first guest. Since being sworn in as Gary's new mayor, Jerome Prince has called for the demolition of 10 vacant schools in the city. He's traveled to Indianapolis to meet with lawmakers and attended a groundbreaking ceremony for Gary's new Hard Rock Casino with members of the Jackson 5, I may add. So Mayor Prince joins us in studio right now. Mayor, welcome to Off Mic.
Thank you, Michael.
So let me ask you this. Are you ready to get off the train? Have you had enough already the past couple weeks?
No, we're just getting started. Yeah, we're actually enjoying ourselves.
So tell me, has the job so far, you've got a lot of momentum right now, but is the job, from your vantage point, is it a little bit bigger than you thought it would be?
I think that's a fair statement. You never really know what you get into until you actually get there. But to be certain, I've had a considerable amount of experience over the last 20 years in mm-hmm. several capacities, and so that's prepared me greatly for the challenges ahead.
You know, obviously, you beat Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson back in the primary, and sort of the political structure way it's set up here in Northwest Indiana, you didn't have much of a general election challenger. How has it been to wait this whole time to actually get in office to start doing things?
That's been the toughest part, to be honest right. with you. Yeah, because obviously there's a lot to do and a lot to engage in City of Gary, but we've just been really eager to do so. And yeah, so I'd like to fashion it as the longest transition in history, if you will.
Right.
But glad to be here now.
Do you have a plan sort of for your first 90 days in office, what you hope to accomplish in that time?
We do, Michael. We certainly want to address the issues that we've talked about all during the campaign, and certainly address the promises that we've made. And those would include securing our finances, absolutely getting a grip on public safety, and to address the aesthetics of the city, if you will.
Yes, right. And you're talking about public safety. One of the things one of the very first things you did coming into office was calling for the school city of Gary to demolish 10 vacant schools in the city. What's the point of doing that?
Well, thank you for that question. Very simply, from day one, since we've entered this race, public safety has always been the number one priority from our perspective. We want to make sure that we have a safe city. And so to this point, those establishments were formerly places where we educated our children. And for the last 10 years or so, mm-hmm. they've become layers of crime and just certainly not conducive to the quality of life that our residents deserve.
You know, people are going to say, well, we don't have the money. It takes a lot of money to demolish these buildings. Are you sort of done with the excuses? Are you ready to say, hey, look, we got to do something to get rid of these buildings because not only are they an eyesore, they're dangerous to the public?
Well, I think the fact that we've chosen to use the UBL, the unsafe building law, suggests that we are done with excuses. And from my perspective, there's never a really good excuse when the community is affected by situations like that, and particularly they lead to lapses in public safety.
You know, from my vantage point, covering the city covering some of the great things happening in the city and the not so great things, it almost feels like you may have to be the mayor of two cities, one where you're trying to generate economic development. You were at the groundbreaking for the new casino in Gary, but you're always having to now deal with hands-on with the number one issue always affecting Gary, which is public safety. There's already been 3 homicides in the city since the start of the new year. How is that affecting you now as the city of mayor, as the mayor of Gary?
Well, it's, you know, something that as a resident of Gary that I've been, aware of, and certainly citizens deserve better and are demanding more. And so to that perspective, we think that we've made the right decision in selecting Colonel Richard Legan to lead our police department. And to that extent, we feel like we're in confident hands, and we're just going to continue pressing forward, addressing the issues that are most important to our community. And again, public safety being the number one issue.
Is there any significant or something where the public may see in terms of changes in the way the police deals with the public, and in terms of maybe more cooperation from them, or maybe using calls to generate tips on leads on crime? What is the police department concretely doing to try to address crime?
So that's a question that's probably better answered by Colonel Legan. And to that extent, I think I made it expressly clear that as an administration, we certainly don't want to tie his hands. From my perspective, I'm going to make sure that he has all the resources, personnel, equipment-wise, to perform to the best of his ability. But to your point, we certainly can expect that we'll have open dialogue with our residents and engage them to get just as involved as we are.
Now, how excited are you about the building of the new Hard Rock Casino in Gary? There was a big groundbreaking ceremony yesterday in the city, a lot of excitement. Gary's had a casino now for more than 20 years. Is this sort of a rebirth of the industry in Gary? What is going to change with this new development?
That's a great analogy. So right off the bat, I believe the estimate is another 500 additional jobs. But equally important, we feel that a development of this magnitude sort of exposes Gary in a different light. If you just consider the hundreds of thousands of people who passed through here along 80-94, that means that other people who come through the city will have something more attractive to look at, and the ultimate desire is that other business entities will decide that if Hard Rock, a major brand such as Hard Rock, has decided to invest their resources in the Gary, that maybe something else is happening there, and maybe it is a good opportunity to take a second look. And so we're extremely excited about it, to say the least.
Are you going to worry at all about the sort of changing market conditions in the Chicago area as it deals with a casino industry? Because already Chicago is supposed to be getting one somewhere. We're not sure where in Chicago, but theoretically, just 20 miles to the west of Gary in Homewood, there could be a casino there, or maybe one in Calumet City. Do you worry about things like that? Competitors, maybe in Matteson, which isn't too far away from Gary. Or is the market just going to have to deal with it, deal on its own?
So I don't want to dismiss it, but Michael, as you know, I've probably got enough things to worry about, so I'm certainly not trying to invent more. We believe that having a major brand such as Hard Rock and with their partnership with Spectacle, that we're certainly on good footing, and we'll just sort of, as you suggested, let the market kind of take care of itself. I think one of the most attractive things about Hard Rock is that they're more than just a gambling or a betting institution. They actually offer entertainment venues, and we're hoping that that entertainment and the revived interest in the Jackson family being involved with the city of Gary as well as Hard Rock, we're thinking that that combination will bring us the type of attention that we need and be able to sustain the growth of that particular facility.
Now, already on this week, you traveled down to Indianapolis to meet with lawmakers. How did that trip go, and what were you asking for?
The trip was excellent. So we went down to check on a couple of legislative initiatives that we are advancing down there to make sure that they have been attached or either attached to another bill, that is, or at least sponsored in the form of legislation. And we're pretty excited about where we're headed with that. As you know, it's a short session, and
right.
So we expect to continue to get positive feedback. We have a legislative call headed for or scheduled for today to get an update, and we'll continue to do that as the session progresses.
How were you received down in Indianapolis? Obviously, Indiana is a very red state. Do you even worry about things like that when you head down there?
I don't. Not at all. And again, I point back to my experience and the work that I've done in the various capacities that I've held, most recently as Lake County Assessor. I say that to say, and it's easy for me, to tout my successes in that. But I think that, and I'm certain, based on the responses that we've received downstate, that that's resonated, and the reception was just phenomenal. To be clear.
Now, I've been seeing a lot of, obviously, social media plays a big role in our society now. A lot of comments from non-Gary residents on how they, are looking to your administration with kind of, kind of inquisitive of what's going to happen. You know, what can non-Gary residents do for the city of Gary? I mean, can they play a part in trying to rejuvenize the city?
They absolutely can, and I believe it starts with helping to reshape the narrative of the city. For some time here, there's just been so many negative perceptions and images associated with the city. I believe that people outside of Gary are just excited, if not more, than the people in the city, and I don't think that it's simply because I took office. It's because they've seen the evidence of my work ethic and my integrity and the character as an elected official. And I believe that's what they're excited about. And to that extent, I think we can expect some different ideas and different perspectives moving forward of the city of Gary.
Now, Mayor, what will success mean for your administration? Half a year from now, a year from now, 2 years from now, what is a success or turning around the city going to look like under your administration?
It's great, Michael. So to me, success is viewed in a couple different perspectives. But instead of looking a year out because of the magnitude of the issues that we face, we sort of take it in 90-day increments, if you will. And so in 90 days, we expect that there will be very visible changes that continue to at least increase the attention that the city's getting. The other side of success for me is a personal one, and I liken it to personal success being if I wake up every day and I work as hard as I can and I do my very best to change the image of the city and realize some accomplishments, for me, that's a success.
And if there was like just three goals that you hope to accomplish, I know you're taking it in 90-day increments, but just three things you would like to see changed in the city, improved upon, or implemented, say in the next year, what were the three things would be?
That's a fair question. So I absolutely would like to see a cleaner city, without question. I'd like to see a city that is attractive to investors or people who are interested in economic development opportunities in the city and to realize some of those opportunities. But most of all, I want to see a safe city, one that attracts other persons who would like to call Gary home, such as myself. And to do that, it sort of goes back to our initiative to demolish or eliminate some of the blight, starting with the schools. We absolutely have to make a better environment for the younger people and for our children.
Mayor, I only got a couple of more questions. One of the things, I'm usually driving into Gary pretty much every day because my daughter goes to Indiana University Northwest, such a great school. How can the city better partner with a university, sort of have maybe a more cohesive relationship, more cooperation? How do you plan to do that?
So I think the city has a decent relationship with the university now, but as you just suggested, that could always be enhanced. One way that we could certainly do that is an initiative that we talked about during the campaign and something that we'll engage in again in discussions with the university, and that is a more cohesive relationship in trying to establish a better or new school system. We believe that our public school system should be directly tied to one of the universities, and certainly with Indiana University being in Gary, we certainly start there. But we wouldn't just limit that sort of exposure to IUN. We have Purdue that's slightly to the west of us, and we believe those type of opportunities are what's going to change our school system. We believe that a combination of those two is what will encourage others to take a second look at Gary and want to educate their children, rather, and make Gary a home.
You know, my last question is, how are you, what's the relationship going to be like? I know a lot of people like to visit Miller Beach, the Miller area of Gary during the summer. There seems to be a lot of nice shops down there already. I know there's some construction work down there, but there seems always to be sort of animosity or disconnect between Miller and the rest of the city. How is your relationship going to be there with that area of the city?
Well, I'm extremely familiar with Miller, having grown up there for a portion of the time as a child. I've recently relocated to the Miller section of Gary. My wife and I, we bought a home in Miller. We certainly enjoy the benefit of having a huge degree of support out of that community. And so, to your point, I believe that it's extremely important that Miller, we realize any potential benefit there to increase economic development and home ownership out there as well, but that we do it in conjunction with realizing the same type of initiatives or opportunities in the rest of the city. And one area that I particularly think of is the Glen Park area or University Park, as you mentioned. I think that if we create those type of synergies and share equal resources and opportunities all over the city, that's how you change that narrative or that disconnect that you spoke about.
Well, Jerome Prince is the new mayor of Gary, Indiana. He just took office not even a week and a half ago. Mayor Prince, thank you so much for joining us here on Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Michael, the pleasure is all mine. Thank
Good
you.
Good luck. Thank you. And coming up, how folks in Puerto Rico are dealing with the latest rounds of earthquakes. We'll be back.
The Friday Pitch-In kicks off with a look at Indiana's biggest headlines of the week, like teachers getting what they want, lawmakers are fast-tracking the iLearn Hold Harmless bill, and IDEM says ArcelorMittal is fudging the numbers. Speaking of IDEM, we'll look at the report that says the agency has seen its funding drop by nearly $35 million in the last decade, and we'll hear from one of the local volunteers helping out wildlife rescue efforts amid the devastating fires in Australia. Next time on All In.
Tune in weekdays at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
There's more ways to listen to Lakeshore Public Radio than just 89.1 FM. You can get Lakeshore Public Radio on the go at your convenience with NPR One. The free app is available via iTunes, Google Play, and Windows App Stores. When you download NPR One, Select WLPR as your local station and start listening. NPR One will customize the stories and content from Lakeshore Public Radio and NPR based on what you listen to, share, and save. It's public radio made personal.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Well, over the past week, more than half the residents in Puerto Rico have been living without power as the island's strongest earthquake in more than a century happened just last week. The quake was so strong that it knocked some homes off their foundations. Since December 28, there have been nearly 2,000 earthquakes in Puerto Rico. And joining me by phone from Puerto Rico is Ed Chivery. Ed is a Chicago native who now lives on the island. Ed, how you doing down there?
I'm doing okay at the moment, Miguel. We're rocking and rolling here.
Well, welcome to Off Mic, too. And so, you know, I do have you as a Facebook contact. And as these earthquakes were happening, I also saw some kind of festival was happening down there. And I'm thinking, is this how do they party down in Puerto Rico even during an earthquake?
Well, interesting is that that center of the epicenter was about 30 miles away. And the earthquake that hit Monday wasn't really felt much here at all, and the power was not affected. So people went on their way here. They're very resilient here. They continue with so much that has happened after Maria. They continue. They've seen a lot. So on that day, what you saw in the festival was in the Three Kings Festival in the town of Moca, which, again, is about 30 miles away from the epicenter. It wasn't until the next morning, Tuesday morning, when the island felt the big one there.
Now, what city do you live in Puerto Rico, and how far, what part of the island is that, and how far away is that, say, from San Juan?
From San Juan, the island, I think, is roughly 100 by 35. We're probably about 70 miles from San Juan, and we are in the northwest corner next to the airport called Ramey, which at one time was the Strategic Air Force Base here, a B-52 bomber base.
Wow. Okay. So, Ed, you know, growing up, you've spent a lot of time in Chicago, of course. So when these earthquakes are happening, are you, like, telling your wife, honey, I'd rather be stuck in a blizzard in, you know, 30 below zero than having to do with earthquakes? Are you okay with the earthquakes?
I am not okay with the earthquakes, Michael. My wife is much stronger than I am in that factor aspect of it. I told her a couple of times. I said, honey, you know, we can go. And she says, no, she doesn't want it. She loves it here, although she's not a native of Puerto Rico. She's not Puerto Rican. She loves it here, and she's not leaving here. Things are better today than they were yesterday, for example. I'll share with you, at 4:30 in the morning on Tuesday was a big quake that my home is a cinder block construction, typical for here, and it shook this house really, really scary. And so we got up, and about 6 o'clock we headed out to go get, to get gasoline. My car only had about a quarter of a tank, and I said, oh, I want to get gasoline. And we had lost power already after that first quake. I understand that the plant close to Guanica, which is very close to the epicenter, was damaged heavily. We went to get gas, and the gas lines had already formed. I waited about 15 minutes to get gas, and we filled up the car, and then we headed out to get water, to make sure we had water. Although I do have a tank here, most people here now have their own water tanks that they fill whenever they can. Because of after Maria, they saw that they could be for months without water supply, fresh water supply from the city. So my water supply was good, but I didn't have electricity to run the motor on it. So and a generator needs gas. We went out, we got some water, and I was hoping that things would be better during the day. Perhaps we'll hear some news. And thank God we had not lost internet capability, and I was able to keep my phone charged through my car. And we heard that it would be several days for electricity. So I headed over to a town about 30 miles away, 35 miles away, Arecibo, Hatillo. And we went to a Sam's Club there, and I purchased an inverter, generator inverter. And I brought that home, and a neighbor gave me some gas out of a can because I couldn't get gas out of my car. The new cars, you can't siphon gas out of. And we got that going and plugged in the refrigerator and the water pump, so we were good there. So we wrote it out yesterday also, just quietly hoping and keeping. And I, you know, watching news where I can, mostly on my phone, and very glad that we did not lose the internet service.
Yeah,
and
late
last night, about 11 o'clock, the power came on for us here. And we were, you know, thrilled. And in the meantime, you know, we had the dealing with the refrigerator and melting ice and such. But we're very happy today to report that I did a quick look at the news items here locally. It appears that better than two-thirds of the island now has power, and maybe 85% or so by Sunday. I think the immediate area around Guanica has damage to the infrastructure, transformers, poles, wires, substations that they'll need to take care of there. But it is amazing. You pointed out that festivals go on. The island has seen a lot of things happen to it. And these people are, as my wife said, they're very resilient.
Well, Ed, let me ask you this. Was this your first earthquake that you've been through?
First ever. Don't want to feel another one. First ever. Don't care to see it. You know, I know back in Chicago, we don't have my daughter's in Colorado, and we don't have forest fires or bears or earthquakes and stuff like that. But you know, Mike, it's about 85 degrees right now. And sunny.
Yeah, oh man. So, but when you were describing the earthquake when it was hitting, what was your initial reaction? Did you even think it was an earthquake, or did you just think it was something else?
I think we are close to the airport, and although we're not in the runway path, once in a while they practice military path practices, and they have some big planes. At first, I thought it was one of their big jets flying overhead close by. And then things just started shaking, and you hear it, and you say, oh, this is not good. And it said, do we run for the door? Do I hit the floor? You know, in about 30 seconds, it passed. But my understanding is looking at, and I have friends that live close to the epicenter that I have been, they still have internet, and a lot of people there are sleeping outside or in the local coliseums that they have any, you know, big open places that can be secured. So they are still doing that at this point right now. And I just read also that they don't have running water, and the government is supposed to be shipping in water, bringing in water. And I would think that by now they have at least drinking water available to them.
Now, Ed, obviously Puerto Rico went through a lot with Maria and the other hurricanes. How are the islanders feeling right now? Are they feeling like they're a little snake bitten with all these, catastrophes directed at them from Mother Nature?
Well, it makes them tough, but yes, people, you hear that. You know, what's next? What's next? What else is God going to throw our way? Yet they're resilient. They continue. My neighbors here are yesterday. Most of them went off to work. I have. Being close to the airport here, there's FedEx here, Hewlett Packard, Lufthansa. A lot of them work in those areas there. But they do say, man, wow, what else is going to happen to us?
And in terms of some of the cleanup after the hurricanes, Hurricane Maria, do you think any of that initial work to restore power to Puerto Rico has either helped or sustained the island during these earthquakes?
I cannot document that, but I would guess, I was in the electrical industry for 33 years before I retired. I would guess that, yes, that some of that new infrastructure that was put in shortly after Maria, because it was new, it helped out quite a bit. I would say yes is my guess. I'm not that'd be a guess, but I would say yes.
All right. And let me, in terms of help from the federal government, obviously, it always seems Puerto Rico gets in some kind of crosshairs with President Trump. Do you feel the federal government is doing enough to aid Puerto Rico in this latest earthquake?
So, Mike, we're going to run an hour and a half on this show now because That's a long discussion. And I can only say that I can say that I think there's a little bit of finger pointing all over the place. But these are U.S. citizens here. They go off. They get they used to get drafted. They were given citizenship in 1917, just in time for World War One, where many of them were drafted and went off to war. And they, many of them, a lot of my neighbors are veterans. They're U.S. citizens, and I would expect our president to treat us that way. And you know, we don't need bickering between mayors and governors and stuff like that. Look at the people. If he has a problem, if he thinks that there's corruption down here, fine, send the money and send the staff, send some people down here to work to make sure that the money is used wisely. He likes to brag about his the unemployment rate. He can put more people to work, send the engineers down here, make sure that the money is spent wisely. But this is U.S. territory. Let nobody tell you anything different.
Well, Echeverria is a Chicago area native. He's now living in Puerto Rico and is dealing with the earthquakes. Ed, thank you so much for joining us here on Lakeshore Public Radio on Off Mic, and please stay safe.
Thank you very much, Miguel. Very nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, and we'll be back with more Off Mic. Hey, I tell you what.
Ringing in the new year with Balm's Natural Foods. Join us on Let's Eat for an hour of healthy tips, facts, and suggestions from Balm's. In the studio, we'll be joined with Leslie and Lauren from Balm's Natural Foods from Merrillville. Call in 769-9577, add to the conversation, and win a gift card to Balm's Natural Foods. Tune in to Let's Eat with Sharon Jackson and me, Chef Nick, for an hour of healthy tips without the drugs. This Friday at 3 o'clock on 89.1 FM, Lakeshore Public Radio, WLPR. Call in and join the fun. Yasu!
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. State Representative Chris Chung is a Northwest Indiana legislative in Indianapolis right now for the new session for the 2020 General Assembly session. Lakeshore Public Radio's Chris Nolte recently sat down with him in a quiet conference room at the Lake County Public Library branch in his district to talk about the session and the issues. Here's the conversation.
As we go into this very first week, very first days, literally days of the General Assembly session, first, what do you have planned in representing the district here in Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, so for me, it's always been about education and healthcare, especially. Those are key planks of our agenda. And this year, I'm also focusing on some labor issues related to the recent story about Amazon and operating in central Indiana and the death of a worker and the investigation that happened thereafter, and where there's accusations of misconduct there and unethical behavior by the Indiana OSHA. So I'm concerned about those, and we're going to introduce some legislation potentially via bill or via amendment form. But for me, I would say the two most exciting bills that I will be introducing myself, even though they're not related to education or healthcare, I'm hoping that they'll go to my own committees, though. One is on payday lending, which was a big topic last year because it didn't necessarily fall along strict partisan lines. We had Republicans voting with Democrats as well against the payday lending proposal. So what I'm proposing is closing the online payday lending loophole. It's something that The industry, the payday lobby industry, has been saying, well, since we have storefront payday lending in Indiana, we're subject to more rules than the online lenders who aren't subject to the same rules. So then we said, well, we have to close that loophole. Thanks for letting us know. I'm hoping that will go back to financial institutions on the committee that I serve. And then the other one I'm hoping that will go to local government, which I'm a ranking minority member on, is source of income discrimination for renters. Basically, if you are a creditworthy, no criminal background, tenant who's able to pay the full market asking price for rent, you can still be discriminated against just because you're dependent on a federal voucher known as Section 8, which to me I think is crazy because a dollar is a dollar no matter how you earned it. Mm-hmm. So I would say those two I'm most excited about.
Let's go back to the payday lending issue here. Is that a major problem that you have seen or you have gotten word from your constituents on here in Northwest Indiana?
You know, in my district immediately, I don't think there are that many people who use payday lenders. So it's mainly in the surrounding communities, North Lake County, the urban areas, lower income areas that are really suffering under this. But as I'm a member on the Financial Institutions Committee, we do see a real need to rein these operators in because anyone is just one big medical bill or one car repair away from financial instability. And we don't want to exacerbate that, which is what all of the evidence shows. If we expand dramatically triple-digit rate APR short-term interest loans to Hoosiers, then we are putting them at more financial risk, and that's not the direction we want to move in.
Now, it may or may not be perceived as such, but this could be probably an issue that goes back into the 20th century of loan sharking, which has been proven with many, many times and instances and evidence that organized crime is deeply involved in loan sharking. Do you think that the payday lending issue is something that's related, or it may not be quite as devious, maybe not quite as criminal, but just same, it's pretty serious?
Yeah, the industry is more dressed up nowadays, to be quite frank about it. But on that point, it is a good parallel you can draw between old-fashioned times, because we're talking about usury here as well. We in the last session, we joined alliances with the religious community, the faith-based community, because they were saying, look, if you pass this law, it's biblical usury. We're not going to support this. We also teamed up with veterans who are preyed on a lot of times on these short-term high-interest rate loans. So it was kind of a strange bedfellows type mix that we were able to defeat last year's proposal.
On the issue about the housing question, about vouchers and the financial value of them, is this an issue that it's kind of mainly federal in some respect because it's FHA and HUD in this case with the vouchers? Is this an issue that here again that Northwest Indiana tends to face more or the more urban counties in Indiana?
Yeah, absolutely. It is in the urban counties, but also increasingly in the rural communities. We're seeing evictions go up, and we're seeing more people with less stability in their own housing options. And this bill is all about providing people the opportunity to put their first, to grab the first rung of that ladder of economic prosperity and get themselves out of poverty. Why are we limiting housing freedom choices to lower income people, which historically traps them into poverty, based on statistics and data, instead of allowing them more options as to where they can live and for them to get into the more upwardly mobile communities? Absolutely.
I'm sure you had opportunities to talk with your colleagues at the House and the Senate here in Northwest Indiana about the issues. What do you see as the issues going into this 2020 General Assembly session?
We anticipate overall that it will be a quick session for a few reasons, but it doesn't seem like there's many ambitious proposals by leadership to do very much this year, which can be frustrating to some people who want to see government taking a more active role and can be pleasing to people who want to see government have a less active role. We were very vocal last year on the education front about raising teacher salaries. We have the lowest paid teachers in the Midwest. We have some of the lowest per capita funding in the entire country. We are number one in the nation in cuts to teacher pay in the last decade. These are statistics that we do not want to have on Indiana's badge. We really want to be able to show that we're doing all we can for education, but the leadership, frankly, has not shown the initiative to step up to the plate on that.
I know that's also been one issue, the teacher pay and any kind of financial issues has been brought up by even State Senator Karen Talion has said some time ago that she hopes that if it's been discovered that there's some money that's available that can be readjusted in the budget, even though the budget itself is pretty much locked in for the rest of the cycle, that they ought to at least take advantage and reallocate some of that money to some of these areas that need it the most.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, tax collections are high. It's a strong, relatively strong economy from a few years ago. If we're not paying our teachers in a strong economy like this, just imagine how terrible it could get in a recession when we have to make even more deep cuts to public services like education, like healthcare funding. That is what really concerns me about the future of Indiana.
Do you think that this is an election year, mainly for the not only for the state but for the federal government too? Of course, do you think that there's going to be some impact that we're going to see, maybe not necessarily on the floor of the Indiana House, but certainly in the state house in general, because we have the politics of the issues that are going to come about this time around?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everyone plays politics. I'm cynical about it, and I'm kind of annoyed at my colleagues who go up there and grandstand or, you know, introduce bills that are strategic votes to jam each other on certain things. I mean, the inevitability is that it's going to happen. I don't know what form it's going to take with impeachment going on and with whatever new revelations might come out from that or on certain hot-button issues like redistricting for next year. These are all things that have a big federal impact, of course, and that we at the state level have a big platform and a voice to put out those issues on for sure.
So you think it's going to be a challenge to try to get some of these issues through the General Assembly with all this louder noise coming from Washington?
Yeah, I mean, I give credit to my colleagues. I think most of them, for the most part, are pretty good at tuning out what happens in Washington and able to work in a little bit more of a bipartisan fashion. And the priorities that I've chosen around helping renters climb out of poverty and on cybersecurity initiatives and on data protection and surveillance technology, some of the other bills that I've filed, all of those issues aren't super strict partisan bomb-throwing things, in my opinion. So I like to think that I'll be able to get Republican support on them, and that's just kind of how I operate. Not every legislator does operate in that vein. A lot of the times, the odds are against Democratic bills getting heard in committee just because of the partisan breakdown. But so they'll, you know, file something that they know has no chance but can be used as kind of like a rallying cry for their base, whereas I'm kind of like, let's try to get some business actually done for once.
Well, the best of luck to you in the upcoming session. This being a short session, so it's not going to be months long. It'll probably be, about 90 days or so, maybe at the most?
Yeah, probably even shorter at that from what we're hearing, maybe 70.
Well, that's a very, very real possibility. State Representative Chris Chung, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
And thank you for Chris Nolte for that great interview. And coming up on Off Mic, we're going to talk about the White Sox. They seem to be loading up, but are they really ready to win? That's coming up.
The Friday Pitch-In kicks off with a look at Indiana's biggest headlines of the week, like teachers getting what they want, lawmakers are fast-tracking the iLearn Hold Harmless bill, and IDEM says ArcelorMittal is fudging the numbers. Speaking of IDEM, we'll look at the report that says the agency has seen its funding drop by nearly $35 million in the last decade, and we'll hear from one of the local volunteers helping out wildlife rescue efforts amid the devastating fires in Australia. Next time on All In.
Tune in weekdays at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio. There's more ways to listen to Lakeshore Public Radio than just 89.1 FM. You can get Lakeshore Public Radio on the go at your convenience with NPR One. The free app is available via iTunes, Google Play, and Windows app stores. When you download NPR One, select WLPR as your local station and start listening. NPR One will customize the stories and content from Lakeshore Public Radio and NPR based on what you listen to, share, and save. It's public radio made personal.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
ringing in the new year with Baum's Natural Foods. Join us on Let's Eat for an hour of healthy tips, facts, and suggestions from Baum's. In the studio, we'll be joined with Leslie and Lauren from Baum's Natural Foods from Merrillville. Call in 769-9577, add to the conversation, and win a gift card to Baum's Natural Foods. Tune in to Let's Eat with Sharon Jackson and me, Chef Nick, for an hour of healthy tips without the drugs. This Friday at 3 o'clock on 89.1 FM, Lakeshore Public Radio, WLPR. Call in and join the fun. Yasu!
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Well, it's cold outside right now, but the White Sox seem to be making it really hot, picking up a lot of new players, and the White Sox are getting a lot of their fans excited for the upcoming season. Joining me to talk about some of the latest moves by the White Sox is veteran Chicago sports journalist Cheryl Ray Stout. Hey, Cheryl, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you? Happy 2020.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And we're going to be joined here, too, also in this conversation in studio by longtime local sports writer for the Post Tribune, John Mucka. Hi, John. How you doing?
Nice to be here. Thanks, Mike.
John, I don't know if you know Cheryl or Cheryl if you know John, but welcome to both of you on for Off Mic.
Actually, we did bump into each other quite often at both Wrigley Field and what used to be Comiskey Park.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great. Well, Cheryl, the White Sox seems to be picking up a lot of players right now. How excited are you, or you think the fans will be for this upcoming season?
Well, if you gave out a trophy for off season, they'd win it. But it should be tempered because, you know, everything's on paper right now. Until you see everything on the field, if it all works out, that'd be great. But it does say something that the White Sox sold out Saturday's Sox Fest. So that says an awful lot about the positivity that they're getting right now.
And is this going to put a lot more pressure on the manager, Rick Renteria, to start winning? He hasn't had a winning season since joining the White Sox. Is this just going to be that much more pressure on him to at least have a winning season?
I think it will be, but I think he wants it at this point. This is something he's been wanting for a while, to prove to everybody, including the team from the north side of Chicago, the Cubs, that he's a winning manager. They did only have 72 wins last year, but what the interesting thing is that Rick Hahn, the general manager, had a list of what he wanted in the offseason, and he got every single thing that he wanted on that list. Now Ricky has to take it and take it to the next level. So, you know, the thing is Ricky is one of those managers that the players really enjoy being with. Sometimes his decision you have to question here and there, but overall he's got a team that has bought into him, and that's pretty important nowadays.
Especially being bilingual with so many Latins on the roster.
Yeah, that's a point that I think every team should either have a manager or minimally a bench coach that speaks Spanish.
So, Cheryl, talk a little bit about the latest acquisitions by the White Sox. We know they just signed a couple of weeks ago Yasmani Grandal, and mm-hmm. just this week, and when Encarnacion and Steve Cisek, who's going to be in part of their pitching rotation. So tell us a little bit about these players.
Well, you know, the fact that they signed two left-handed pitchers, Dallas Keuchel and Gio Gonzalez. Gio Gonzalez, of course, is a veteran. He was with the Sox a couple of times, but never in the major league roster. But Dallas Keuchel, we're talking about a former All-Star player, a Cy Young winner, and a World Series winner. Now, he may not be the pitcher he was a few years ago, but when you have a young core staff, you need a veteran like that to help them learn the ropes of what it's like to be in a very competitive situation, which they hadn't been in. And you look at the fact that they now have two All-Star catchers, Yasmani Grandal and James McCann. So you have your veteran leadership behind the plate. And when we were talking to Dallas Keuchel, one of the reasons why he came to the White Sox was because of the catching situation, which says an awful lot about what those two players can mean. But you look at the other, Edwin Encarnacion, they finally have a designated hitter. Instead of trying to make somebody a designated hitter, they have a hitter that has hit 32 home runs at least the last eight seasons. So those are very good numbers to have for this team right now. But I think the other big coup that they did was signing Luis Robert to a long-term deal so he could start in the major leagues rather than being sent to AAA. And the other pickup they got, they traded for Nomar Mazara. Don't know what he's going to be able to do because he was a high prospect for Texas, had a little bit of a down year, but he may solidify right field and a left-hitting bat.
Well, Cheryl, on the other side of town with the Cubs, I mean, I still keep hearing that they're still trying to work out a deal with Chris Bryant, that maybe he could be, you know, on the trading block. What's the latest on his situation?
Nothing will happen until his grievance is revealed. He and his agent they have a grievance against the Cubs about keeping him down in the minor leagues in 2015. If he wins that grievance, he'll be a free agent after this year. If he loses, he will be a Cub for 2 years unless they trade him. So a lot of things are riding on that. You realize the Cubs are one of two teams that have not signed a free agent of any worth in the offseason. It was the Cubs and the Colorado Rockies. So there's a lot of disappointment right now with the Northsiders.
You know, I do know some of the things that both you and John have covered in the past is college basketball. College basketball is really big in Chicago and in Indiana. And, John, you've followed Indiana University's basketball team for a long time. But, you know, it's been over 30 years since IU has won a basketball title. Do you still see Indiana University as a basketball university?
Well, it certainly is, but I think that the fan base is a little out of touch with reality because they're no longer among the kingpins. I mean, they're not in a class with Duke and Kentucky and North Carolina anymore, although they would like to be, certainly.
Who do you see as the top dog in terms of college basketball in the state of Indiana?
Well, right now it looks like Butler. They're 14-1. And they're one of the best defensive teams in the country, make very few errors, never beat themselves, and they've been able to win on the road, which is something that neither Purdue or Indiana have been able to accomplish this year.
And in Chicago, we know that a couple of seasons ago, Loyola made a big splash in the NCAA Final Four. DePaul's been playing pretty well. Cheryl, how big do you think college basketball is in the city of Chicago?
It's not as big as it was during the heyday, especially when Ray Meyer was a head coach of DePaul and Gene Sullivan was at Loyola. But I think that Dave Lato he's done a good job of getting transfer students to help re-energize the program. They had a great pre-conference. But now that they're in their conference schedule, it's not going to be as easy. And so the hope is that maybe they can turn the corner and really, you know, have a possibility to get an NCAA berth. But Loyola, you know, Porter Moser, you know, it's a good team. Again, he gets transfer students. He does a good job. Cameron Crutwick is a really good player in the middle. But they, you know, the mid conferences just don't get the big names, they have to get students that come into the program that's willing to, you know, like do everything but maybe not succeed. And that's hard for some players. So, you know, Loyola, DePaul, I think Illinois is really starting to shine a light on themselves. I think that Underwood's doing a good job down there right now. But right now, college basketball, I think the one and done has really hurt all of college basketball.
That's right. John, what do you see universities in Indiana, Purdue, Notre Dame, what do they have to do to sort of get back to that upper echelon of college basketball?
Well, what Purdue's been able to do to continue to play at a high level is he's done a good job of getting players who stay more than a year. Indiana's had some problems along those lines. When it seems like the program is beginning to get on a roll, well, like last year, the guy they got from New Albany leaves after 1 year, and now right now they really don't have any veteran leadership on that team. And I watched them play Northwestern last weekend, and after the game, they won it, but I felt like they'd lost it because Northwestern really outplayed them a good part of the way, and Northwestern was a very depleted team with a couple of their top players out with injuries. And but Indiana just doesn't have seems to fall apart when the going gets tough, and they just don't have that veteran leadership.
Sure, we only got a couple of minutes. Tell us something positive about the Chicago Bulls.
Well, the All-Star Game's in a few weeks. That's a positive. That's United Center. I think Coby White is a bright spot for them. I think that we may be seeing some changes at the end of the season right now, you know, as things look right now. Chris Dunn is quite the, you know, the defensive, you know, presence on the court. But it's hard times right now for them.
Well, you can catch more of Cheryl Ray Stout's reporting on WBEZ. Cheryl, thank you so much for being here on Off Mic. And John Mutka, you could used to be on the Post Tribune. We thank you so much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that's all the time we have for this show. I've Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. Want to thank the producers, Dee Donson, Jose Rodriguez, and Tom Maloney. And, you know, stay tuned for more on Lakeshore Public Radio. Want to thank you for listening and happy first show of the year for us here. And stay warm. It's supposed to snow this weekend, and hopefully it won't snow too much. Thank you so much.